This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Terminal Experiment by Robert J. Sawyer, narrated by Paul Hecht. This work is copyrighted 1995 by Robert J. Sawyer. This recording is copyrighted 2003 by Recorded Books. The author opens with the following quote from Dag Hammarskjöld, United Nations Secretary General from 1953 to 1961. In the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all the questions life puts to us. And now, The Terminal Experiment.
In the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all the questions life puts to us. Dag Hammarskjöld, 1905 to 1961, the United Nations Secretary General. Prologue, December 2011. What room is Detective Philo in? Asked Peter Hobson, a tall, thin man of 42 with hair an equal mixture of black and gray. The squat nurse behind the desk had been absorbed in whatever she'd been reading. She looked up. Pardon? Detective Sandra Philo, said Peter, what room is she in? 412, said the nurse. But her doctor has ordered that only immediate family members should visit. Peter began down the corridor. The nurse came around from behind the desk and gave chase. You can't go in there, she said firmly. Peter turned briefly to look at her. I have to see her. The nurse maneuvered in front of him. She's in critical condition. I'm Peter Hobson. I'm a doctor. I know who you are, Mr. Hobson. I also know you're not a medical doctor. I'm on the board of directors of North York General. Fine. Go over there and bully someone, then. You're not raising havoc on my ward. Peter exhaled noisily. Look, it's a matter of life and death that I see Ms. Philo. Everything in the ICU is a matter of life and death, Mr. Hobson. Ms. Philo is sleeping, and I'll not have her disturbed. Peter pushed ahead. I'll call security, said the nurse, trying to keep her voice low so as not to alarm the patients. Peter didn't look back. Fine, he snapped, his long legs carrying him quickly down the corridor. The nurse waddled toward her desk and picked up the phone. Peter found 412 and entered without knocking. Sandra was hooked up to an EKG. It wasn't a Hobson unit, but Peter had no trouble reading its display. A drip bag of saline was on a pole beside her bed. Sandra opened her eyes. It seemed to take a moment for them to focus. You, she exclaimed at last, her voice raw and thin, the effects of the beamer. Peter closed the door. I've only got a few moments. They've already called security to come and take me away. Every word was a struggle for Sandra. You tried to have me killed, she said. No, said Peter. I swear to you, that wasn't my doing. Sandra managed a weak shout, too faint to be heard through the closed door. Nurse! Peter looked at the woman. When he'd first met her only a few weeks ago, she'd been a healthy 36-year-old with flaming red hair. Now her hair was falling out in clumps. Her complexion was sallow and she could barely move. I don't want to be rude, Sandra, Peter said, but please shut up and listen. Nurse! Listen, damn it. I had nothing to do with the murders, but I know who did, and I can give you a chance at getting him. At that moment the door burst open. The squat nurse entered, flanked on either side by a burly security guard. Remove him, said the nurse. The guards moved forward. Damn it, Sandra, said Peter. This is your only chance. Give me 5 minutes. One guard grabbed Peter's upper arm. 5 minutes, for God's sake, that's all I ask. Let's go, said the guard. Peter's tone was imploring. Sandra, tell them you want me to stay. He hated himself for what he said next, but he couldn't think of anything more effective. If you don't, you'll die never having solved the crimes. Come along now, buddy, said the other guard gruffly. No, wait, Sandra, please, come along, Sandra. Finally, a voice weak and wan. Let him stay. We can't do that, ma'am, said one of the guards. Sandra rallied a little strength. Police business. Let him stay. Peter twisted free of the guard's grip. "Thank you," he said to Sandra. "Thank you." The nurse scowled at him. "I won't stay long," Peter said to her. "I promise." Sandra managed to roll her head slightly in the nurse's direction. "It's okay," she said faintly. The nurse was seething. The tableau held for several seconds. Then the woman nodded. "All right," she said. Perhaps the talk of police business and unsolved crimes convincing her she was out of her depth. "Thank you," Peter said to the nurse, relieved. "Thank you very much." The nurse scowled, turned on her heel, and left, followed immediately by one of the guards. The other guard backed out, his face an angry mask, all the time pointing a warning finger at Peter. When they were alone again, Sandra said, "Tell me." Peter found a chair and sat down beside her bed. "First, let me say I'm terribly, terribly sorry about what's happened. Believe me, I never wanted you or anyone else to come to harm. This is all out of control." Sandra said nothing. "Do you have any family, any children?" "Daughter," said Sandra, surprised. "I didn't know that." "With my ex now," she said. "I want you to know I'm going to take care of her financially, everything she needs, clothes, cars, university, vacations in Europe, whatever. I will pay for it all. I'll set up a trust fund." Sandra's eyes were wide. "I never intended any of this, and I swear to you that I've tried repeatedly to stop it all." Peter paused, thinking back to how the whole damn thing had started. Another hospital room, trying to comfort another brave woman who was dying. It comes full circle. "Sarkar Mohammed was right. I should have come to you before. I need your help, Sandra. This has to end." Peter exhaled, wondering where to begin. So much had happened. "Did you know," he said at last, "that it's possible to scan every neural net in a human brain and produce an exact duplicate of the subject's mind inside a computer?" Sandra shook her head slightly. "Well, it is. It's a new technique. Sarkar Mohammed is one of its pioneers. What would you say if I told you that my brain had been scanned and duplicated?" Sandra lifted her eyebrows. "Two heads, better than one." Peter acknowledged the comment with a wry smile. "Perhaps. Although, actually, a total of 3 simulations of me were made." "And one of these committed murders?" Peter was surprised by how quickly Sandra grasped it. "Yes. Thought AI was involved." "We've tried to stop them," said Peter. "Nothing worked. But at least I know now which simulation is guilty." He paused. "I'll give you everything you'll need, Sandra, including full Q&A access to the scans of my brain. You'll get to know me in intimate detail better than anyone in the real world knows me. You'll know how I think, and that will give you the knowledge to outwit the murdering simulation." Sandra lifted her shoulders slightly. "Nothing I can do," she said, her voice weak and sad. "Dying." Peter closed his eyes. "I know. I'm terribly, terribly sorry, but there is a way, Sandra. A way for you to end all this." Chapter 1, January 1995. Sandra Philo probed the memories of Peter Hobson. The horror she learned had started in 1995, 16 years ago. Back then, Peter Hobson hadn't been the center of a controversy about science and faith that was shaking the world. No, back then he was simply a 26-year-old grad student at the University of Toronto, doing his master's degree in biomedical engineering. A student who was about to have the shock of his life. The phone rang in Peter Hobson's dorm room. "We've got an eater," said Koufax's voice. "You up for it?" An eater. A dead person. Peter was trying to get used to Koufax's callousness. He rubbed sleep from his eyes. "Yes," he tried to sound more confident. "Sure," he said. "Sure thing." "Mamikonian's going to start the slice and dice," said Koufax. "You can ride the EKG. That'll take a good hunk out of your practicum requirements." Mamikonian. Stanford-trained transplant surgeon, 60-something, hands steady as a statue's. Organ harvesting. Christ, yes, he wanted in on that. How soon?
Couple of hours, said Koufax. Kid's on full life support. Keep the meat fresh. Amaconian is out in Mississauga. It'll take him that long to get here and prepped.
Kid, he'd said. Some kid's life cut short. What happened? Asked Peter.
Motorcycle accident. Kid was thrown through the air when a Buick sideswiped him.
A teenaged boy. Peter shook his head.
I'm in, he said. OR3, said Koufax. Start prep in an hour.
He hung up. Peter hurried to get dressed. He wasn't supposed to do it, Peter knew, but he couldn't help himself. On the way to the OR, he stopped at emergency admitting and checked the aluminum clipboards in the swivel-mounted rack. One guy being sewn up after going through a plate-glass window, another with a broken arm, knife wound, stomach cramps. Ah, Enzo Bandello, 17. Motorcycle accident, just as Koufax had said. A nurse sidled up to Peter and looked over his shoulder. Her name badge said Sally Cohan. She frowned.
Poor kid. I got a brother the same age.
A pause. The parents are in the chapel. Peter nodded. Enzo Bandello, he thought. 17. In trying to save the boy, the trauma team had given him dopamine and had deliberately dehydrated him in hopes of reducing the brain swelling normally associated with a severe head wound. Too much dopamine, though, would damage the heart muscle. According to the chart, at 2:14 a.m., they'd begun flushing it from his body, and fluids were being pumped in. Latest reading showed his blood pressure was still too high, an effect of the dopamine, but it should come down soon. Peter flipped pages. A serology report. Enzo was free of hepatitis and AIDS. Blood count and bleeding studies looked good, too. A perfect donor, thought Peter. Tragedy or miracle? His parts would save the lives of a half-dozen people. Mamaconian would take the heart out first, a 30-minute operation, then the liver, 2 hours' work. Next, the renal team would remove the kidneys, another hour's cutting. After that, the corneas, then the bones and other tissues. There wouldn't be much left to bury.
Heart's going to Sudbury, said Sally. Cross-matching was excellent, they say.
Peter put the clipboard back into the carousel and walked through the double doors that led to the rest of the hospital. There were two equally good routes to OR3. He chose the one that went by the chapel. He was not a religious person. His family, back in Saskatchewan, was white-bred Canadian Protestant. Last time Peter had been in church was for a wedding. Time before that, a funeral. He could see the Bandellos from the hallway, seated in a middle pew. The mother was crying softly. The father had an arm around her shoulders. He was a deeply tanned man, wearing a plaid work shirt with cement stains on it. A bricklayer, perhaps. A lot of Toronto's Italians of his generation worked in construction. They'd come over after World War II, unable to speak English, and had taken hard labor jobs to make a better life for their kids. And now this man's kid was dead. The chapel was denominationally neutral, but the father was looking up as if he could see a crucifix on the wall, see his Jesus hanging there. He crossed himself. Somewhere in Sudbury, Peter knew, there was a celebration going on. A heart was coming. A life would be saved. Somewhere there was joy. But not here. He continued on down the corridor. Peter arrived at the scrub room. Through a large window, he could see into the operating theater. Most of the surgical team was already in place. Enzo's body had been prepped, his torso shaved, 2 layers of rust-colored iodine painted on, clear plastic stretched over the surgical field. Peter tried to get a look at that which the others had been trained to ignore, the face of the donor. Not much of it was visible. Most of Enzo's head was covered by a thin sheet exposing only the ventilator tube. The transplant team was deliberately kept ignorant of the donor's identity. Made it easier, they said. Peter was probably the only one who knew the boy's name. There were 2 scrub sinks outside the OR. Peter began the regulation 8 minutes of washing, a digital timer above the sink counting down the time. After 5 minutes, Dr. Mamaconian himself arrived and began scrubbing at the second sink. He had steel-gray hair and a lantern jaw. More like an aging superhero than a surgeon.
You are?
Asked Mamaconian as he scrubbed.
Peter Hobson, sir. I'm a grad student in biomedical engineering. Mamikonian smiled. Good to meet you, Peter. He continued to scrub. Forgive me for not shaking hands, he said, chuckling. What's your role today? Well, for our coursework, we're supposed to log 40 hours of real-world experience with medical technology. Professor Koufax, he's my thesis advisor, arranged for me to operate the EKG today. He paused. If that's all right with you, sir. That's fine, said Mamikonian. Watch and learn. I will, sir. The counter above Peter's sink bleeped. He wasn't used to this. His hands felt raw. He held his dripping arms out at chest height. A scrub nurse appeared with a towel. Peter took it, dried his hands, then stepped into the sterile green gown she was holding for him. Glove size? She asked. 7. She tore open a package, removed the latex gloves, and snapped them onto his hands. Peter entered the OR. Overhead, a dozen people were watching through the glass ceiling from the observation gallery. In the center of the room was a table holding up Enzo's body. There were several tubes going into it. 3 volume lines, an arterial line to monitor blood pressure, a central venous line threaded into the heart to monitor hydration level. A young Asian woman sat on a stool, her eyes scanning the volume monitor, the CO2 monitor, and the volumetric infusion pump. Until his arrival, the woman had also been watching the EKG oscilloscope mounted above Enzo's head. Peter moved into position next to it and adjusted the contrast on the display. The pulse rate was normal, and there was no sign of damage to the heart muscle. It chilled him. The guy was legally dead, and still he had a pulse. I'm Hua, said the Asian woman. First time? Peter nodded. I've been on a few little things before, but nothing like this. Hua's mouth was covered by a face mask, but Peter could see her eyes crinkle in a smile. You get used to it, she said. Across the room, an illuminated panel had Enzo's chest X-ray clipped to it. The lungs hadn't collapsed, and the chest was clear. The heart, a silhouette in the center of the image, looked fine. Mamikonian entered. All eyes turned to face him, the conductor for their orchestra. Good morning, everyone, he said. Let's go to work, shall we? He moved in to stand over Enzo's body. Blood pressure's falling a bit, said Hua. Crystalloid fluid, please, said Mamikonian, glancing at the readouts. And let's add a little dopamine back in. Mamikonian stood on Enzo's right, next to his chest. Across from him was the scrub nurse. A surgical assistant stood next to her, holding the abdominal wall retractor. 5 1-liter containers of ice-cold Ringer's lactate were lined up in a neat row on a table, so they could be emptied quickly into the chest cavity. A nurse also had 6 units of packed red blood cells ready to go. Peter tried to stay out of the way, near the head of the bed. Next to Peter, the perfusionist, a Sikh wearing a large green cap over his turban, scanned a series of readouts labeled remote temperatures, arterial vent, and cardiac sucker. Nearby, another technician carefully watched the rising and falling of the ventilator's black bellows to make sure Enzo was still breathing properly. Let's go, said Mamikonian. A nurse moved in and injected something into Enzo's body. She spoke into a microphone dangled on a thin wire from the ceiling. Myalok administered at 10:02 a.m. Dr. Mamikonian requested a scalpel and made an incision starting just below the Adam's apple and continuing down the center of the chest. The scalpel split the skin easily, sliding through the muscle and fat until it banged against the breastbone. The EKG shuddered slightly. Peter glanced at one of Hua's monitors. Blood pressure was rising, too. Sir, said Peter, the heart rate is acting up. Mamikonian squinted at Peter's oscilloscope. That's normal, he said, sounding irritated at being interrupted. Mamikonian handed the scalpel, now slick and crimson, back to the nurse. She passed him the sternal saw, and he turned it on. Its buzzing drowned out the blipping from Peter's EKG. The saw's rotating blade sliced through the sternum. An acrid smell rose from the body cavity. Powdered bone. Once the sternum was cut apart, 2 technicians moved in with the chest spreader. They cranked it around until the heart, beating once per second, was visible. Mamikonian looked up. On the wall was the digital ischemic counter, It would be started the moment he excised the organ, measuring the time during which there would be no blood flowing to the heart. Next to Mamikonian was a plastic bowl filled with saline. The heart would be rinsed in there to get old blood off it. It would then be transferred into an igloo container filled with ice for the flight to Sudbury. Mamikonian requested another scalpel and bent down to cut through the pericardium. And just as his blade sliced through the membrane surrounding the heart, the chest of Enzo Bandello, legally dead organ donor, heaved massively. A gasp escaped from around his ventilator breathing tube. A moment later, a second gasp was heard. "Christ," said Peter softly. Mamikonian looked irritated. He snapped his gloved fingers at one of the nurses. "More myoluck." She moved in and administered a second shot. Mamikonian's voice was sarcastic. "Let's see if we can finish this damn thing without the donor walking away, shall we, folks?" Peter was dazed. Mamikonian departed with the excised heart. Since that meant there was no more need for an EKG operator, Peter went up to the observation level and watched the rest of the harvesting from there. When it was done, when Enzo Bandello's hollow corpse was sewn shut and rolled off to the morgue, Peter staggered down to the scrub room. He found Hua, who was pulling off her gloves. "What happened in there?" Peter asked. Hua exhaled noisily. She was exhausted. "You mean the gasping?" she shrugged. "Happens every once in a while." But the donor was dead. "Of course. But he was also on full life support. Sometimes there's a reaction." And what was that business with myoluck? What's that?" Hua was untying her surgical gown. "It's a muscular paralyzer. They have to administer that. If they don't, sometimes the donor's knees tuck up toward the chest as you carve into it." Peter was appalled. "Really?" "Uh-huh." Hua dropped her gown into the hamper. "It's just a muscular reaction. Nowadays it's routine procedure to anesthetize the corpse."
"Anesthetize the corpse?" said Peter slowly.
"Yeah," she said. "Of course, Diane obviously didn't do a good enough job today." Hua paused. "It gives me the willies when they start moving like that, but hey, that's transplant surgery for you."
Peter kept a little copy of the timetable for his girlfriend, Kathy Churchill, in his wallet. He was in the first year of his master's, she was in her last year of her bachelor's in chemistry. She would be finishing her final class of the day, polymers, in about 20 minutes. He hurried back to the campus and waited in the hall outside the classroom for her. The class ended, and Kathy came out chatting animatedly with her friend Jasmine, who caught sight of Peter first.
"Well," she said, grinning and tugging Kathy's sleeve, "look who's here. It's Mr. Wright."
Peter smiled at Jasmine briefly, but really only had eyes for Kathy. Kathy had a heart-shaped face, long black hair, and enormous blue eyes. As always, she smiled radiantly when she saw Peter. Despite what he'd seen earlier in the day, Peter felt himself grinning, too. It happened every time. There was an electricity between them. Jasmine and their other friends often commented on it.
"I leave you two lovebirds alone," said Jasmine, still grinning.
Peter and Kathy said goodbye to her, and the two of them came together in a kiss. In that brief moment of contact, Peter felt himself revitalized. They'd been dating for 3 years now, and still there was wonder in each embrace. When they separated, Peter asked, "What are you doing for the rest of the day?"
"I'd been planning to drop by the arts department to see if I could get some kiln time, but that can wait," Kathy said, her voice mischievous.
Overhead, every other fluorescent tube had been removed to cut costs, but Kathy's smile lit up the whole corridor for Peter.
"Got any ideas?"
"Yes, I want you to come to the library with me."
Again, the wondrous smile.
"Neither of us is that quiet," said Kathy.
"Even if we did it somewhere that'd likely be deserted, the Canadian literature section, maybe, I suspect the noise would still disturb people."
He couldn't help grinning, and he leaned in to kiss her again.
"Maybe afterward," he said, "but first I need help with some research, please." They joined hands and began walking.
"Into what?"
"Into death," Peter said. Kathy's eyes were wide.
"Why?"
"I was doing some more of my practicum today, running an EKG during an operation to remove a heart for transplant."
Her eyes danced. "That sounds fascinating."
It was, but...
But what?
But I don't think the donor was dead before they started removing his organs.
Oh, come on,
said Kathy, letting go of his hand long enough to whap him lightly on the arm. I'm serious. His blood pressure went up when the surgery started, and his heart rate increased. Those are classic signs of stress or even pain, and they anesthetized the body. Think about that. They anesthetized a supposedly dead person.
Really?
Yes. And when the surgeon sliced into the pericardium, the patient gasped.
My God, what did the surgeon do?
Called for more muscular paralyzers to be injected into the patient, then just went on with the operation. Everyone else seemed to think this was all perfectly reasonable. Of course, by the time the operation was finished, the donor really was dead. They left the Lash Miller building and started walking north toward Bloor Street.
And what do you want to find out? Asked Kathy.
I want to find out how they determined that someone is dead before they begin carving out his organs. They'd been searching for about an hour when Kathy came over to the carrel Peter was sitting in.
I found something, she said.
He looked up expectantly. She pulled up a chair and balanced a heavy volume on her lap. This is a book on transplant procedures. The problem with transplants, it says, is that they never take the body off life support. If they did so, the organs would begin to deteriorate, so even though the donors are declared dead, their hearts have never stopped. As far as the electrocardiogram is concerned, the supposedly dead donor is as alive as you and me. Peter nodded excitedly. This was exactly what he'd been hoping to find. So how do they decide if the donor is dead? One way is to squirt ice-cold water into his ears.
You're kidding, he said.
No. It says here that will completely disorient a person even if they're in a deep coma, and it often causes spontaneous vomiting.
Is that the only test?
No, they also rub the surface of the eyeball to see if the donor tries to blink, and they pull out the... what do you call it? That breathing tube?
The endotracheal ventilator.
Yes, she said. They pull that out for a short time to see if the body's need for oxygen will cause it to start breathing again on its own.
What about EEGs?
Well, this is a British book. When it was written, their use for determining death wasn't required by law.
Incredible, said Peter.
But surely they have to use them here in North America, don't they?
I imagine so, in most jurisdictions.
And this donor you saw today would have flatlined before they ordered his organs removed?
Probably so, said Peter.
But in the course I took on EEGs, the prof talked about people who had completely flatlined, subsequently showing some brain activity.
Kathy paled somewhat.
Still, she said, even if the donor is still alive in some small sense.
He shook his head.
I'm not sure it's such a small sense. The heart is beating, the brain is receiving oxygenated blood, and there are signs that pain is being experienced.
Even so, said Kathy, even if all that's true, it must also be true that a brain that's shown no activity for an extended period must be severely damaged.
You're talking about a vegetable.
Probably, said Peter.
But there's a difference between harvesting organs from the dead and ripping them from the bodies of the living, no matter how severely mentally handicapped that living person might be.
Kathy shivered and went back to searching. She soon found a 3-year study of cardiac arrest patients at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. 1/4 of the patients diagnosed as having no heartbeats did, in fact, still have them, as detected by catheters inserted into their bloodstreams. The report hinted that patients were being declared dead prematurely. Meanwhile, Peter found several relevant London Times articles from 1986. Cardiologist David Wainwright Evans and 3 other senior doctors were refusing to do transplant operations there because of the ambiguity over when the donor is actually dead. They'd set out their concerns in a 5-page letter to the British Conference of Royal Medical Colleges. Peter showed the articles to Kathy.
But the conference dismissed their concerns as unfounded, she said.
Peter shook his head.
I don't agree.
He met her eyes.
It'll say in Enzo Bandello's obituary tomorrow that he died from head injuries sustained in a motorcycle accident.
That's not true. I saw Enzo Bandello die. I was right there when it happened. He was killed by having his heart carved out of his chest. Chapter 2, February 2011. Detective Sandra Filo continued to sift through Peter Hobson's memories. Starting after his graduation in 1998, he had worked for several years at East York General Hospital, then had founded his own biomedical equipment company. Also in 1998, he and Kathy Churchill, still very much in love, had gotten married. Kathy had given up her interest in chemistry. Peter didn't yet understand why. Instead, she now worked in a non-creative position for Duap Advertising, and every Friday after work, Kathy and her co-workers went out for a drink. Actually, as Sandra discovered, although they referred to their intentions in the singular, the reality was decidedly plural. Drinks. And by the end of the evening, several of them always managed to successfully conjugate the verb form drink, drank, drunk, often of the praying to the porcelain god variety. It was cold and dark, a typical February evening in Toronto. Peter walked the 7 blocks from the 4-story Hobson Monitoring Building to the Bent Bishop. Kathy's co-workers weren't really his sort, but he knew it was important to her that he make an appearance. Still, Peter always tried to arrive after everyone else. The last thing he wanted to do was make small talk with an account manager or an art director. There was something superficial about advertising that turned him right off. Peter pushed open the bishop's heavy wooden doors and stood in the entryway, his eyes adjusting to the dim interior. On his left was a blackboard with the daily specials printed on it. On his right was a poster for Molson's Canadian, depicting a curvy woman in a red bikini with maple leaves crowning each of her upturned breasts. Sexism in beer advertising, thought Peter. Past, present, probably forever. He stepped out of the entryway and scanned the pub, looking for Kathy. Long gray tables at random angles were tightly packed throughout the room, like aircraft carriers in an oceanic traffic jam. In the background, 2 people were playing darts. Ah, there they were, clustered around a table positioned against a wall. Those whose backs were to the wall, decorated with a poster of another Molson's bimbo, were seated on a couch. The rest were in captain's chairs, drinks in hand. Some were sharing a bowl of nachos. The table was big enough that 2 or 3 separate conversations were going on, the participants shouting to be heard above the blaring music, an old Mitsu tune played louder than the speakers could really handle. Kathy was a very bright woman. That had been the first thing that attracted Peter to her. It was only later that he redefined his own standards of feminine beauty, which had tended toward bouncy blondes a la the beer ads, to find her jet-black hair and thin lips beautiful. She was sitting on the long couch. 2 of her co-workers, Toby, was it, and that lout Hans Larsen on either side of her, so that she couldn't get out unless one of them moved first. Kathy looked up as Peter approached, smiled her radiant smile and waved. Peter still felt a thrill when she smiled. He wanted to sit next to her, but the current deployment of bodies made that impossible. Kathy smiled again, love plain on her face, then shrugged apologetically and gestured for him to take an unused chair from the adjacent table. Peter did so, and Kathy's co-workers shifted along to make room for him. He found himself sitting between one of the painted ladies on his left, the secretaries and production coordinators who wore too much makeup, and the pseudo-intellectual on his right. As always, Pseudo had a book reader sitting in front of him, the cover of the data card visible through the window in the reader's shell. Proust, ostentatious bastard. "Evening, Doc," said Pseudo. Peter smiled. "How you doing?" Pseudo was about 50 and slim as the Leafs' chances in the Stanley Cup. His fingernails were long, his hair dirty. Howard Hughes in training. Others acknowledged Peter's presence, and Kathy gave him another special smile from across the table. His arrival had been enough to momentarily stop the separate conversations. Hans, on Kathy's right, seized the opportunity to grab everyone's attention. "The old ball and chain won't be home tonight," he announced generally. "Off to visit her nieces." That they were Hans's nieces, too, didn't seem to occur to him. "That means I'm free, ladies." The women around the table groaned or giggled. They'd all heard this sort of thing from Hans before. He was hardly what you'd call a handsome man. He had dirty blonde hair and looked something like the Pillsbury Doughboy. Still, his incredible boldness was appealing. Even Peter, who found Hans's infidelity distasteful, had to admit that there was something inherently likable about the man. One of the painted ladies looked up. Her crimson lipstick had been applied in a shape bigger than her actual lips.
"Sorry, Hans, I've got to wash my hair tonight."
General laughter. Peter glanced at the pseudo-intellectual, to see if the notion that cleaning one's hair might be a priority had registered on him. It hadn't.
"Besides," said the woman, "a girl has to have her standards. I'm afraid you don't measure up."
Toby on Kathy's left chuckled.
"Yeah," he said, "they don't call him Little Hans for nothing."
Hans smiled from ear to ear.
"As my daddy used to say, you can always go round the edges."
He looked at the woman with the painted-on lips.
"Besides, don't knock it until you've been knocked by me," he roared, delighted at his own wit. "Ask Anne Marie in accounting. She'll tell you how good I am."
"Anna Marie," corrected Kathy.
"Details, details," said Hans, waving a mitten-like hand. "Anyway, if she won't vouch for me, ask that blonde temp in payroll, the one with the big kasabas."
Peter was growing tired of this. "Why don't you try dating her instead?" he said, pointing at the woman in the Molson's poster. "If your wife comes home unexpectedly, you can fold her into a paper airplane and send her sailing out the window." Hans roared again. He was good-natured. Peter would give him that.
"Hey, the doc made her funny,"
he said, looking from face to face, inviting them all to share in the supposed wonder of Peter having told a joke. Embarrassed, Peter looked away, and happened to catch the eye of the young man serving drinks. He raised his eyebrows at him, and he came over. Peter ordered a large orange juice. He didn't drink alcohol. Hans wasn't one to let go, though.
"Go ahead, Doc, tell us another joke. You must hear lots of them in your line of work,"
he roared again.
"Well," said Peter, deciding to make an effort to fit in for Kathy's sake, "I was talking to a lawyer yesterday, and he told me a funny one."
Two of the women had gone back to munching on nachos, evidently uninterested in his joke, but the rest of the group was looking at him expectantly.
"See, there's this woman who killed her husband by hitting him over the head with a cruet of a salad dressing."
When the joke had been told to Peter, it had been about a husband killing his wife, but he couldn't resist reversing the roles in the hopes of planting the thought in Hans's head that Hans's wife might not approve of his philandering.
"Well," Peter continued, "the case finally comes to trial, and the Crown Attorney wants to introduce the murder weapon. She picks up the cruet off her desk. It still has a little glass stopper in its mouth and is mostly full of liquid. She begins carrying it toward the judge. 'Your Honor,' she says to the judge, 'this is the very item by which the deed was done. I'd like to enter it as Crown Exhibit Number 1.
The lawyer holds it up to the light.
"As you can see, it's still full of oil and vinegar.
Well, at once, the defense attorney rises to his feet and pounds the table in front of him.
'I object, Your Honor,' he shouts. 'That evidence is immiscible.'
They all stared at him. Peter grinned to show that the joke was over. Kathy did her best to laugh, even though she'd heard the joke the night before.
'Immiscible?'
Peter said again, weakly. Still no general response. He looked at the pseudo-intellectual. Pseudo made a condescending little chuckle. He got it, or was pretending to have, but the other faces were blank.
'Immiscible,' said Peter. 'It means they can't be mixed.'
He looked from face to face. 'Oil and vinegar?'
'Oh,'
said one of the painted ladies, and
'Ho, ho,'
said another.
Peter's orange juice arrived. Hans pantomimed a bomb dropping, whistling a descending note as it fell, then making a sound like an explosion. When he looked up, he said, 'Hey, everyone, did you hear about the whore who—'
Peter suffered through another hour, although it seemed longer. Hans continued to hit on the women collectively and individually. Finally, Peter had had all he could take of him of the noise and of the lousy orange juice. He caught Kathy's eye and glanced meaningfully at his watch. She smiled a thank-you-for-your-indulgence smile just for him, and they got up to leave.
"'Off so soon, Doc?'
said Hans, speech noticeably slurred, his left arm now having taken up residence on the shoulders of one of the women. Peter nodded.
You should really let Kath stay out later.
The unfair remark angered Peter. He nodded curtly, she said her goodbyes, and they headed for the door. It was only 7:30, but it was already black overhead, although the glare from the streetlights banished the stars. Kathy took Peter's arm, and they walked slowly along.
"I get pretty tired of him," said Peter, his words appearing as puffs of condensation.
"Who?" said Kathy.
"Hans."
"Oh, he's harmless," said Kathy, snuggling closer to Peter as they walked. "All bark and no bite?"
"Well, I wouldn't quite say that," she said. "He does seem to have dated just about everyone in the office."
Peter shook his head. "Don't they see through him? He's only after one thing." She stopped and reached up to kiss him.
"Tonight, my love, so am I."
He smiled at her and she at him, and somehow it didn't seem cold outside any more at all. They had made wondrous love, their naked forms mingling, each attentive to the other's desires. After 12 years of marriage, 17 of living together, and 19 since they had first dated, they knew the rhythms of each other's bodies. And yet, after all that time, they still found new ways to surprise and please each other. Finally, after midnight, they had fallen asleep in each other's arms, calm, relaxed, spent, in love. But about 3 a.m., Peter awoke with a start, sweating profusely. He'd had the dream again. The same dream that had been haunting him for 16 years now. Lying on an operating table, pronounced dead but not, scalpels and sternal saws cutting into him, his organs being removed from his torso. Kathy, still naked, awoken by Peter's sudden movement, slipped out of bed, got him a glass of water, and sat, as she had on many nights before, holding him tight until the terror had passed.
Chapter 3. Peter had seen the ads in magazines and on the net. Live forever. Modern science can prevent your body from ever wearing out. He thought it was a scam until he saw an article about it in Biotechnology Today. A California company apparently could make you immortal for a fee of $20 million. Peter didn't really believe it was possible, but the technology involved sounded fascinating. And now that he was 42, the realization that he and Kathy were only going to have a few more decades together was the one thing in his life that made him sad. Anyway, the California company, Life Unlimited, was putting on seminars around North America promoting their process. In due course, they came to Toronto, renting meeting space at the Royal York Hotel. It was impossible to drive in downtown Toronto anymore. Peter and Kathy took the subway to Union Station, which connected directly with the hotel. The seminar was being held in the plush Ontario Room. About 30 people seemed to be in attendance, and...
"Uh-oh," said Kathy softly to Peter. Peter looked up.
Colin Godoyo was approaching.
He was the husband of Kathy's friend Naomi and a vice president of the Toronto Dominion Bank. A rich guy who liked to show it off. Peter was quite fond of Naomi, but had never really thought much of Colin.
"Petey,"
said Colin, loudly enough so that every head in the room turned to look at them. He shoved a beefy hand toward Peter, who shook it.
"And the gorgeous Catherine,"
he said, leaning in for a kiss, which Kathy reluctantly provided.
"How wonderful to see the two of you."
"Hi, Colin,"
said Peter. He jerked a thumb toward the front of the room where the presenter was setting up. "Thinking about living forever?"
"It sounds fascinating, doesn't it?"
said Colin.
"What about you two? The happy couple can't bear the thought of till death do us part?"
"I'm intrigued by the biomedical engineering," said Peter, somewhat put off by Colin's presumption.
"Of course,"
said Colin, in an irritating, knowing tone.
"Of course. And Kathy, want to keep those great looks of yours forever?"
Peter felt the need to defend his wife. "She has a degree in chemistry, Colin. We're both just intrigued by the science behind the process." At that moment, the presenter spoke loudly from the front of the room.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we're ready to begin. Please take your seats."
Peter spotted two unoccupied chairs in an otherwise full row and quickly steered himself and Kathy toward them. Everyone settled in to listen to the sales pitch.
"Nanotechnology is the key to immortality.
the fellow from Life Unlimited said to his audience. He was a muscular African-American, mid-40s, salt-and-pepper hair with a wide smile. His suit looked like it cost $2,000.
"Our nanotechnology machines can prevent every aspect of aging."
He indicated the picture on the wall screen, a blow-up of a microscopic robot.
"Here's one now," he said. "We call them nannies because they look after you."
He chuckled, and invited the audience to chuckle as well.
"Now, how do our nannies, which we distribute throughout your body, prevent you from growing old?"
asked the man.
"Simple. A large part of aging is controlled by timers on certain genes."
"Well, you can't eliminate the timers. They're necessary to the regulation of bodily processes. But our nannies read their settings and reset them as required. The nannies also compare the DNA your body is producing to images of your original DNA. If errors get introduced, the DNA is corrected at the atomic level. It's not much different from error-free computer communications, really. Checksums allow fast and accurate comparisons. The ravages caused by buildups of toxic wastes in the body are also a major part of aging, but our nannies take care of all of that for you, cleaning the wastes out. Autoimmune problems such as rheumatoid arthritis are another component of aging. Well, we've learned a lot about the autoimmune system in trying to cure AIDS, and we can now take care of almost anything that comes along. But the very worst part of aging is the loss of memory and cognitive functions. In many cases, that's due simply to a lack of vitamin B6 or B12. It's also caused by not enough acetylcholine and other neurotransmitters. Again, our nannies balance all the levels for you. And what about Alzheimer's? It's genetically programmed to kick in at a certain age, although the onset can also be caused by high levels of aluminum. Our nannies get down and dirty with your genes, turning regulators on and off. We find the instruction for Alzheimer's, if it exists in your DNA, not everyone has it, and just prevent it from expressing itself.
The man smiled.
Now I know what you're thinking. None of that is going to help me if I get shot in the chest by a mugger. Well, using patented Life Unlimited techniques, we can even make sure you live through that. Yes, the bullet will stop your heart. But our nannies monitor your blood oxygen levels, and they themselves can deliver blood to the brain if need be, acting like tractors pulling red blood cells. And yes, you'll need a heart transplant and maybe some other repair work, but your brain will be kept alive until that work is done. Okay, now you're thinking, hey, what if that mugger had shot me in the head instead?
The pitchman lifted up a thin sheet of what looked like silver foil.
This is polyester D5. It's similar to Mylar.
He held the sheet by one corner and let it flutter in the air.
Less than half a millimeter thick, he said. But watch this.
He proceeded to attach the sheet of foil to a square metal frame, anchoring it on all four sides. He then produced a gun with a silencer sticking off in the front.
Don't worry, he said. I've got a special permit for this.
He chuckled.
I know how you Canadians feel about guns.
He aimed the pistol at an angle and fired at the foil sheet. Peter heard the pistol bark and saw a lick of flame shoot out of its nozzle. There was a sound like a thunderclap, and something happened to the curtain behind the stage. The pitchman went over to the metal frame and held up the Mylar sheet.
No hole, he said.
And indeed that was true. The sheet was rippling in the breeze of the air conditioner.
Polyester D5 was developed for the military and is now widely used in bulletproof vests by police forces all over the world. As you can see, it's quite flexible. Unless it's hit at high speed, then it tightens up and becomes harder than steel. That bullet I fired a moment ago bounced right off.
He looked back. His assistant was coming onto the stage with something held in metal tongs. He dropped it into a little glass bowl on the podium.
Here it is.
The pitchman faced the audience.
We coat the skull in a thin, perforated layer of polyester D5. Of course, we don't have to peel off the scalp to do that. We simply inject nanotechnology drones and have them lay it down. But with your skull protected by this stuff, you could take a bullet to the head, or have a car run over your cranium, or fall headfirst off a building and still not crush your head.
The polyester becomes so rigid, almost none of the percussion is transferred through to your brain.
He smiled brilliantly at his audience. It's exactly as I said at the outset, folks. We can outfit you in such a way that you will not die, not through aging, and not through almost any accident you can conceive of. For all intents and purposes, we offer exactly what we promise, honest-to-God immortality. Now, any checkers?
It was the first Sunday of the month. By long-standing tradition, that meant dinner with Peter's in-laws. Kathy's parents lived on Bayview Avenue in North York. The Churchill House, a 1960s side-split with a one-car garage, would have once been considered good size, but now was dwarfed by monster homes on either side, causing it to spend most of the day in shadow. Above the garage was a rusting basketball hoop with no net attached. Kathy's thumbprint worked on the door lock. She went in first, and Peter followed behind. Kathy shouted out, "We're here!" And her mother appeared at the top of the stairs to greet them. Bunny Churchill, God help her, that was her name, was 62, short, trim, with gray hair that she refused to dye. Peter liked her immensely. Kathy and he headed up into the living room. Peter had been coming here for years, but had still never quite gotten used to its appearance. There was only one small bookcase, and it held audio CDs and some video laser discs, including a complete run of Playboy Video Playmate calendars since 1998. Kathy's father taught phys ed. Gym teachers had been the bane of young Peter's existence, the first inkling he'd had that all adults weren't necessarily intelligent. Worse, Rod Churchill ran his family like a high school football team. Everything started on time. Bunny was rushing even now to get food on the table before the clock struck six. Everybody knew their positions, and of course, everyone followed the instructions of Coach Rod. Rod sat at the head of the table, with Bunny at the opposite end, and Kathy and Peter facing each other on either side. Sometimes they played footsie when Rod got into one of his boring stories. This was turkey month. The first Sunday dinners rotated between turkey, roast beef, and chicken. Rod picked up the carving knife. He always served Peter first. "Our guest first," he'd say, underscoring that even after 13 years of marriage to his daughter, Peter was still an outsider. "I know what you want, Peter. A drumstick." "Actually, I'd prefer white meat," said Peter politely. "I thought you liked dark meat." "I like dark chicken meat," said Peter, as he did every third month. "I like white turkey meat."
"Are you sure?"
asked Rod. "No, I'm fucking making this up as I go along."
"Yes."
Rod shrugged and carved into the breast. He was a vain man. A year from retirement, hair dyed brown, what was left of his hair, that is. He grew it long on the right side and combed it over his bald pate. Dick Van Patten in track suit.
"Kathy used to like drumsticks when she was a little girl," Rod said.
"I still do," said Kathy, but Rod didn't seem to hear her.
"I used to like giving her a big drumstick and watch her try to get a bite out of it."
"She could have choked to death," said Bunny. Rod grunted.
"Kids can take care of themselves," he said. "I remember that time she fell down the stairs."
He laughed, as if life should be one big slapstick comedy. He glanced at Bunny.
"You were more upset than Kathy was. She waited until a big enough audience had arrived before she started crying."
He shook his head.
"Kids got bones made out of rubber."
Rod handed Peter a plate with two ragged slices of turkey breast on it. Peter took it and reached for the bowl of baked potatoes. Friday evenings at the Bent Bishop somehow didn't seem that bad right now.
"I was bruised for weeks," said Kathy a bit defensively.
Rod chuckled.
"On her bum."
Peter still had a long scar on his leg from a high school gym accident. Those darn phys ed teachers. Such funny guys. He waited until everyone was served, helped himself to the gravy boat, then passed it to Rod.
"No, thanks," said Rod. "I'm not eating much gravy these days."
Peter thought about asking why, decided against it, and passed the gravy boat to Kathy instead. He turned to his mother-in-law and smiled.
"Anything new with you, Bunny?" "Oh, yes," she said. "I'm taking a course Wednesday nights. Conversational French. I figure it's about time I learned."
Peter was impressed. "Good for you," he said.
He turned to Rod. "Does that mean you have to fend for yourself Wednesday evenings?" Rod grunted. "I order in from food," he said. Peter chuckled.
Kathy said to her mother, "The turkey is delicious."
"Thank you, dear," said Bunny.
She smiled.
"I remember that time you played a turkey in the Thanksgiving play at school."
Peter raised an eyebrow.
"I didn't know about that, Kathy."
He looked at his father-in-law.
"How was she, Rod?"
"I don't know. I didn't go. Watching children dressed up as livestock isn't my idea of a fun evening."
"But she's your daughter," said Peter, then wished he hadn't. Rod helped himself to some cooked carrots. Peter suspected he would have gone to watch a son play in Little League.
"Dad never took much interest in children," said Kathy, her tone neutral.
Rod nodded, as if this was a perfectly reasonable attitude for a father to take. Peter stroked Kathy's leg gently with his foot. Chapter 4 August 2011 The world goes through two seasons in 6 months. Should it be surprising that other things change a lot in that time, too? Peter had downloaded this week's Time from the net and was glancing through it. World news, people, milestones. Milestones. Births, marriages, divorces, deaths. Not all milestones were so cut and dried. Where were things such as the disintegration of a romance noted? What was the journal of record for lingering malaise, for empty hearts? Who marked the death of happiness? Peter remembered how Saturday afternoons used to be. Lazy, loving, reading the paper together, watching a little TV, drifting at some point to the bedroom. Milestones. Kathy came down the stairs. Peter looked up briefly. There was hope in lifting his eyes, hope that he'd see the old Kathy, the Kathy he'd fallen in love with. His eyes fell back to the text reader. He sighed, not theatrically, not for her ears, but for himself, a heavy exhalation, trying to force the sadness from his body. Peter had inventoried her appearance in that quick glance. She was wearing a ratty U-of-T sweatshirt and loose-fitting jeans, no makeup, hair quickly combed but not brushed, falling in black bunches around her shoulders, glasses instead of contacts. Another small sigh. She looked so much better without the thick lenses balancing on her nose, but he couldn't remember the last time she'd worn her contacts. They hadn't made love for 6 weeks. The national average was 2.1 times each week. Said so, right here in Time. Of course, Time was an American magazine. Maybe the average was different here in Canada. Maybe. This year had been their 13th wedding anniversary, and they hadn't made love in 6 fucking weeks. 6 fuckless weeks. He glanced up again. There she stood on the third stair up, dressed like some goddamn tomboy. She was 41 now. Her birthday had been last month. She still had her figure, not that Peter saw it much anymore. These sweatshirts and two big sweaters and long skirts, these bags she'd taken to wearing, hid just about everything. Peter stabbed the page down button. He tipped his head down, went back to his reading. They used to make love a lot on Saturday afternoons, but Christ, if she was going to dress like that. He'd read the first 3 paragraphs of the article in front of him and realized that he hadn't a clue as to what it had said, hadn't absorbed a single word. He glanced up once more. Kathy was still on the third step looking down at him. She met his eyes for an instant, but then dropped her gaze and, hand on the wooden banister, stepped down into the living room. Focusing on the magazine, Peter said, "What would you like for dinner?"
"I don't know," she said.
"I don't know. The national anthem of Kathyland. Christ, he was sick of hearing that. What would you like to do tonight? What would you like for dinner? Want to take a vacation?"
"I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Fuck it." "I'd like fish myself," said Peter, and again he stabbed the page down button.
"Whatever would make you happy," she said.
"It would make me happy if you talked to me," thought Peter. "It would make me happy if you didn't fucking dress down all the time."
"Maybe we should just order in," said Peter. "Maybe a pizza or some Chinese. Whatever."
He turned pages again, new words filling his screen. 13 years of marriage. "Maybe I'll give Sarkar a call," he said, testing the waters. "Go out and grab a bite with him,
if you like."
Peter shut the reader off. "Damn it, it's not just what I'd like. What would you like?"
I don't know.
It had been building for weeks, he knew, festering within him, pressure increasing, an explosion imminent, his sighs never releasing enough of what was pent up, what was ready to blow. Maybe I should go out with Sarkar and not come back. She stood motionless across the room from him. The staircase rose up behind her. It looked as though her lower lip was trembling a little. Her voice was small.
If that would make you happy?
It's falling apart, thought Peter. It's falling apart right now.
Peter turned the magazine reader back on, but immediately flicked it off again.
It's over, isn't it? He said. 13 years. He should get up from the couch now, get up and leave. 13 years.
Jesus Christ, said Peter into the silence. He closed his eyes.
Peter, eyes still closed. Peter, said Kathy, I slept with Hans Larsen.
He looked at her, mouth open, heart pounding. She didn't meet his gaze.
Kathy moved hesitantly into the center of the living room. There was quiet between them for several minutes. Peter's stomach hurt. At last his voice, raspy, raw, as though the wind had been knocked out of him, said,
I want to know the details.
Kathy spoke softly. She didn't look at him.
Does it matter?
Yes, it matters. Of course it matters. How long has this... he paused. This affair been going on?
Christ, he'd never expected to use that word in this context.
Her lower lip was trembling again. She took a step toward him as if she meant to sit beside him on the couch, but she hesitated when she saw the expression on his face. Instead, she moved slowly to take a chair. She sat down, weary, as if the tiny walk down to the living room had been the longest of her life. She carefully placed her hands in her lap and looked down at them.
It wasn't an affair, she said softly.
What the hell would you call it? Said Peter. The words were angry, but his tone wasn't. It was drained, lifeless.
It wasn't a relationship, she said. Not really, it just happened.
How?
A Friday night after work.
You didn't come that time. Hans asked me for a lift to the subway. We went back to the company parking lot together and got my car. The lot was deserted by then, and it was pretty dark.
Peter shook his head.
In your car? He said.
He paused for a long time, then said softly,
You...
And the next word came slowly, unbidden, released from his lips with a little shrug as if there were no other word that would quite do.
Slut!
Her face was puffy, and her eyes were red, but she wasn't crying. She moved her head back and forth slightly, as though trying to deny the word, a word that no one had ever applied to her before, but then, at last, she also shrugged, perhaps accepting the term.
What happened? Said Peter.
Exactly what did you do?
We had sex, that was all.
What kind of sex?
Normal sex.
He just dropped his pants and lifted my skirt. He didn't touch me anywhere.
But you were wet, anyway.
She bristled.
I'd had too much to drink.
Peter nodded.
You never used to drink, not before you started working with them.
I know, I'll stop.
What else happened?
Nothing.
Did he kiss you?
Before, yes. Not after.
Sarcastic. Did he tell you he loves you?
Hans says that to everyone.
Did he say it to you?
Yes, but it was just words.
Did you say it to him?
Of course not.
Did you come?
A whisper.
No.
And then a tear did roll down her cheek. He asked me if I had come, as if anyone would have, in and out like that. He asked me, I said no, and he laughed. Laughed and pulled up his trousers.
When did this happen?
You remember that Friday I came home late and had a shower?
No.
Wait, yes. You never have a shower in the evening. That was months ago.
February, said Kathy.
Peter nodded.
Somehow the fact that this had happened so long ago made it more bearable.
6 months ago, he said.
Yes, she said.
And then the words like a trio of bullets tearing into his heart.
The first time.
All the stupid questions welled up in his brain.
You mean there were others?
Yes, Peter, that's exactly what she means.
How many times?
Two more.
For a total of three?
Yes.
sarcastic again. "But affair is the wrong word for this." Kathy was silent.
"Jesus Christ," said Peter softly.
"It wasn't an affair." Peter nodded. He knew what kind of person Hans was. Of course it hadn't been an affair. Of course there was no love involved.
"Just sex," said Peter.
Kathy wisely said nothing.
"Christ," said Peter again.
He still had the magazine reader in his hand. He looked at it, thinking he should throw it across the room, smash it against a wall. After a moment, he simply dropped it on the couch next to him. It bounced silently against the cushion. "When was the last time?"
3 months ago," she said, her voice small. "I've been trying to work up the courage to tell you. I didn't think I could. I tried twice before, but I just couldn't do it."
Peter said nothing. There was no appropriate reaction, no way to deal with it. Nothing. An abyss.
I thought about killing myself," Kathy said after a very long pause, her voice attenuated like a pre-dawn wind. "Not poison or slitting my wrists, though, nothing that would look like suicide."
She met his eyes, briefly. "A car accident. I was going to ram into a wall. That way you'd still love me. You'd never know what I'd done, and you'd remember me with love. I tried. I was all ready to do that, but when it finally came down to it, I swerved the car."
Tears were running down her cheeks.
"I'm a coward," she said at last. Silence. Peter tried to make sense of it all. There was no point in asking if she was going to go with Hans. Hans didn't want a relationship, not a real relationship, not with Kathy or any woman. Hans. Fucking Hans. "How could you get involved with Hans? Hans, of all people," asked Peter. "You know what he is." She looked at the ceiling.
"I know," she said softly. "I know."
"I've always tried to be a good husband," said Peter. "You know that. I've been supportive in every way possible. We talk about everything. There's no communication problem. No way you can say I don't listen to you." Her voice took on an edge for the first time. "Did you know I've been crying myself to sleep for months?" They had a pair of bedside fans that they used as white noise generators, drowning out the sounds of traffic from outside, as well as each other's occasional snoring. "There's no way I could have known that," he said. He had occasionally noticed her shuddering next to him as he fell to sleep. Half-conscious, he'd idly thought she'd been masturbating. He kept that thought to himself. "I've got to think about this," he said slowly. "I'm not sure what I want to do." She nodded. Peter threw his head back, let out a long, ragged sigh. "Christ, I have to rewrite the entire last 6 months in my mind. That vacation we took in New Orleans, that was after you and Hans. And that time we borrowed Sarka's cottage for the weekend, that was after, too. It's all different now, all of it. Every mental picture from that time, every happy moment, fake, tainted."
"I'm sorry," said Kathy very softly.
"Sorry?" Peter's voice was ice. "You might have been sorry if it had happened just once, but three times, three fucking times."
Her lips were trembling.
"I am sorry." Peter sighed again. "I'm going to call Sarka and see if he's free for dinner." Kathy was silent. "I don't want you along. I want to talk to him alone. I've got to sort things out." She nodded. Chapter 5. Peter had known Sarkar Muhammad since they'd both been teenagers. They'd lived on the same street, although Sarkar had gone to a private school. They had, perhaps,